Hi there, my name's Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. And I hope you're going to like it. I'm going to be in conversation with well-known, interesting figures. Now, when it gets to the end of that conversation, don't rush off, because we have got the illustrious, wondrous psychologist Karen Cowan on hand to discuss what's been said and to give us some insight and various tips on what we can do with our mental health. It's all going to be great. Enjoy. Welcome to episode 8 of Shed Talks, and today we are really, really delighted to have Ian Rankin as our guest. Ian is probably the most successful British crime writer alive today. He's written over 23 crime novels, featuring the brilliant and wonderful character Inspector John Rebus. Ian attended Edinburgh University, has an honorary degree from Edinburgh, but also from Abbotsby, St Andrews, Hull, as well as Open University. He is the husband of one wife, the father of two sons, and was awarded the OBE in 2003, won the Cartier Diamond Dagger in 2005 in its 20th year, made a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 2016, oh my goodness, and just now won the Outstanding Contribution to Crime Fiction by the much-revered Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Writing of Harrogate. Oh my goodness, he is so bloody successful, I cannot believe this. Now, known for being a regular good guy and exceptionally loyal to his friends and certain musicians. However, apparently it's been said that if you really piss Ian off, you're more than likely to end up in a Rebus novel, being tortured, murdered, or transformed into a taster at a pet food factory in Wyn Canton. Cor blimey, Governor, hark the herald angels. Welcome, Ian.
Well, I think after that, we should just call it a day, shouldn't we? It's all downhill from here.
You're absolutely right. Well, I could mark this day by saying that the main guitarist in ZZ Top departed, but maybe we'll move on from that. I just want to clear up 2 points. You had a punk rock group that was in your head for many months and maybe even years, and I cannot get the name of them right, and I wanted you to tell me.
Well, it depends, really. There was the Ad Hitler Electric Nazi Band when I was at high school.
Yes.
We existed on paper as a prank. We sent a letter to Sounds, which was our music newspaper of the day, a music weekly, with a photograph of us saying we were the great new sound of punk in Scotland. But it was just us sitting in the fifth form common room, making stuff up.
Absolutely brilliant. I love that. And that sounds...
I mean, before that, I was in a band called Kaput, and Kaput was a band that existed only in my diaries when I was a kid.
Ah.
And I was the lead singer. I was Ian Kaput.
Ian Kaput.
And I had all the members of the band, and I would design their album sleeves, and I would write the song lyrics, and... Yeah, not much of that is left. A lot of that got thrown away. But I've still got one of the album sleeves that I designed.
Oh, well, hopefully we could see that. that would be really, really good. Well, you and I have Alex Harvey as a common love, interest, whatever. Sensational Alex Harvey band. And we'll talk about that later. What I wanted to do is to talk about Fife and you growing up in Fife. And I heard you say that it was quite a tough place to grow up in, and it was quite tough to be different.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very small community, mostly a coal mining community. The town hadn't really existed. C- Cardenden hadn't really existed until coal came along in the early 20th century. And so everybody around us was either a miner or married to a miner or related to a miner. My dad was the youngest of six or seven kids, and all the older boys went down the mines. My dad didn't. He went to work in a grocer's shop when he left school, and that was pretty much his life until he reached sort of late 50s when he was made redundant and got another job. It was all working class. Nobody owned their own home. Nobody seemed to own a car. But I felt different, I don't know, kind of from the get-go. I mean, I was a kind of maybe a weird solipsistic kid, a bit introverted. I liked the company of my own head.
Yeah.
I liked to make things up either inside my head, having all these role-playing adventures, or else writing stuff down, trying to do comic books and cartoons and song lyrics and all sorts, sitting in my bedroom. But it didn't do to stick your head above the parapet. So I would look as though I belonged. I would hang around the street corner with all the other kids, wearing my Doc Martin boots and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And then when they all went off to have a big battle with the next village over, I would go home and write about it rather than taking part.
Yes, well, that was probably quite sensible. So your sister gave you a present, I think, of a whole load of diaries and empty diaries.
Yeah, my older sister, she's 7 years older than me, and she started giving me little pocket diaries as a Christmas gift, and there wasn't much in them, there wasn't much space for writing. And eventually she bought bigger and bigger diaries until they were like desk-sized. And I felt duty-bound to fill each page with writing, even though very little was happening in my life. There was very little to write about. And I would make stuff up, or I would have a top 10 list of LPs and singles that I would buy if I had the money, books that I wanted to read, films I wanted to see. And I just got used to that writing stuff down every day, which is a very useful thing if you're going to become a writer.
No, I absolutely. But you went, and it wasn't that long ago, a few years ago, you went on BBC Radio 4 and they had a programme called My Teenage Diary, which I sort of felt rather sympathetic for you, actually, because it was like you were right in front of an audience and it was supposed to all be dead funny, you know, and I thought there were some things that were not, well, that were not dead funny, but you know, everyone was sort of going, oh, hysterical. But one of the things I picked up in, and I suppose because this is a, you know, we're talking about mental health. You had an Aunt Meg, who you said was, I think, taken, you know, you in the diary, you said, oh, Aunt Meg went to mental hospital today. And I wondered, not to be over curious, but whether that had relevance later on.
It's one of these things, you know, I mean, we were a close-knit family, but we were also very buttoned down, so you didn't really talk about your feelings, you never talked about your emotions, and you never really expressed emotion. Possibly at New Year, when everybody'd had a drink, there'd be some singing and dancing. But it was just stuff that happened. You know, my father's older brothers started to die one by one, and yes, Aunt Meg went off to the she was sectioned, I guess. You know, but it was kept from me, and my parents didn't talk about it in front of me. I remember when Aunt Meg's husband died, and my dad went over to the house and came back and gave me an electric razor and said, that's for you. And it was basically my dead uncle's razor, still with the stubble of his beard inside the you know, and just thought, well, it's like any strange thing.
Thanks.
to give to your teenage son, isn't it?
It's
some kind of bequest, that is. But yeah, we never, you know, my parents never really showed much emotion. I don't remember them really kissing and cuddling and stuff
handshaking.
At all. Well, yes, a handshake if you were lucky was a kind of, yeah. it was much later in my life that I came to be around people who regularly embraced you when they met you or gave you a peck on the cheek.
Yeah, my experience of all that stuff, I know exactly what you're talking about, is that you basically, you don't know any different, and therefore you just carry on. And, you know, I mean, this is relevant, I think. you know, you went off to Edinburgh University, the first of your family to be at university, and I think probably thought, I don't know whether you felt a fish out of water or not.
It was more that I was feeling more and more like a fish out of water in my hometown.
Yes.
I was sitting in my bedroom reading Solzhenitsyn or Dante's Inferno, but I couldn't talk to anybody about that. I didn't feel that I could talk to anybody about that, not friends and not family. So when I arrived at Edinburgh University and found myself surrounded by people who were also reading Solzhenitsyn and Dante and wanted to be writers and musicians and put on plays and start magazines and start bands, that was a release. Now, I was a fish out of water insofar as having gone through the Scottish state school system,
Yeah. You
basically learn by rote. You write down everything the teacher tells you,
Yeah. And
you memorize everything, and you go into the exam hall and you spew it out. You didn't do an awful lot of thinking for yourself. And suddenly doing English and philosophy at Edinburgh, I was surrounded by very confident, privately educated kids of my age who could just talk off the top of their heads. And it was weird to be sitting in these tutorial groups, and the working class kids were basically writing every single thing down that anybody said, but not actually talking.
Yes. Yeah.
And it took me 2 or 3 years to become to become more confident that I had something that was worth saying.
Yeah, fascinating, really fascinating. Yeah, I get that. But so what happened to you though was that your mum very sadly died when you were 18, turning 19. Mm. And that must have been quite a big number.
It was devastating because my parents, I was quite a late child. It was both our second marriage. My mum was in her late 30s, my dad in his early 40s when I was born. So by the time I went off to university, they were preparing for retirement, and they were going to have the house to themselves, and they could go and travel, they could have holidays, they could spend some time together instead of working all the hours God gives. And I went off to Edinburgh University October 78. I'd been there a couple of weeks.
Blimey.
When my mum was taken ill.
Right.
And rushed into hospital. And there followed a period where I was going home every weekend, and there was no real diagnosis. Nobody seemed to know what was wrong with my mum, but she was released from hospital. And then was bedbound, and the bed got moved from the upstairs bedroom to the living room downstairs.
Yeah.
My dad sort of looked after her. And that whole first year at university, I was going home watching my mum deteriorate. So there were these two lives that I was living. During the week, I was studying Dickens and Milton, and writing poetry and you know, trying to be in a band and everything else. And then I would come home at the weekend and see old school friends and sit with my dad and my mum. And towards the end of my first year, she died. So, and then I took very ill. I was working in a chicken factory at the summer, and I got meningitis. I think my dad thought he was going to lose his wife and his son in the same few months. It was not diagnosed for a while. And then when it was diagnosed, they rushed me into hospital and gave me a lumbar puncture. And then their period of recovery began. But that was, I mean, I was, as you say, I was 18 and 19. I think I just turned 19. So that was pretty hellish.
That must have had a real effect. I mean, both your mum dying, huge, and then meningitis is not a lightweight thing to have.
No, and my writing got very dark. I'd gone from writing diary entries and poems to writing quite dark lyrics for a new wave band that I was a singer in,
yes,
called the Dancing Pigs, and also starting to explore writing very dark short stories. And I'm sure all of that was cathartic. It was all a way of dealing with the trauma, because again, we never really talked about it.
Yeah.
You know, stuff got cleared. My mum's stuff got cleared out of the house, and my dad just started living his life again. There was no no trauma therapy, no sitting letting off steam.
Yeah.
Absolutely none of that.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, awful. I can see that. And the meningitis, blimey. Tricky stuff. But, I mean, that must have, you know, you must have felt low. I mean, you must have felt, as they say these days, low mood.
Well, possibly, yeah. I think, you know, I just bottled a lot of stuff up.
Yeah.
Didn't talk about it really to anybody.
Yeah.
And as I say, I was very fortunate, I think. I've been fortunate all my life that I can transfer this stuff to the written page in some form or another, whether it's diary entries. I kept a diary going until I was 30 years old. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff is in the diaries, which are, you know, only for personal use.
Yeah.
They're going in the coffin with me when I die, I think. But I could do that, or I could write stories in which I could transfer it to other characters.
Yes.
And through them explore my feelings and how, you know, what my moods. And that probably has saved me a lot of money in therapy down the years.
Yeah, I'm sure. But the good news was that, you know, in the next year or so, you met your soon-to-be wife, Miranda. And that must have been quite a cheerful experience.
Yeah, she was a couple of years old. She was a year above me doing the same course, doing English literature. And the third years and fourth years would get to mingle and sometimes do classes together. And there's a whole gang of us who formed a bond and used to go to the pub every evening with our tutor and discuss literature into the wee small hours. And I wasn't, you know, I was a very timid character. I was very, as I've said, introverted. But yes. Miranda was the opposite. She was extroverted.
Oh, great.
And she was, you know, any adventures that I was going to have in life were all because Miranda dragged me along with her. whether it was hitchhiking through Europe when we left uni, or moving to France, or just all of that, all these things that we would eventually do in our life. If it had been down to me, I would still just be sitting in my favourite pub or in my living room and not really venturing very far at all from home.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. I had a feeling that you had a band at that point, but maybe I got this wrong, that the Germs were there.
The Germs preceded the Dancing Pigs. Now, I wasn't in the Germs.
Sorry.
The keyboard player and the bassist from the Germs became the Dancing Pigs. And invited me along as possible vocalist. And they used to practice at the YWCA or YMCA in Cowdenbeath. So we'd get the train through from Edinburgh to Cowdenbeath midweek evenings, and we would rehearse in this room. The building's no longer there. I've been back to Cowdenbeath and looked for it. And sadly, the keyboard player, Dave Dov Young, died of motor neuron disease a few years ago.
Gosh.
He was an extraordinary. He built his own synthesizer from scratch using plans that you could buy from a mail order business. And he was, you know, he played violin and stuff as well. And he looked like David Sylvian from Japan.
Oh, yes.
At least he tried to look like David Sylvian from Japan. He was Fife's version thereof. But yeah, all of that was great, you know. And
did Miranda like the dance?
No, this was pre-Miranda. Miranda and I started dating in late 81, and the Dancing Pigs was 79-80. So we had broken up because of musical differences, as they say in the trade, by then. But we had gone into a recording studio and we'd made a little tape of four songs, which we duly sent off to John Peel, who never played it. But we know that he kept a very complete archive of everything that was sent to him. So somewhere in the John Peel archive will be a cassette tape from the Dancing Pigs.
Well, I think we should form a movement to have those released, you know.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah, I think so, and I think we've got to do it. So you came down, you know, basically it was time to get cracking on the work and writing, and Miranda was a driving force, and you came down to London, to a part of London known as Tottenham. which some people might know as Tottenham Hotspur, but other people know a different way. And you worked writing for a hi-fi magazine in Crystal Palace, which, I mean, is like you might as well go and live in Edinburgh and commute to Peterborough.
It was quite the commute, I must say. Yeah, I mean, to put it into perspective, my parents thought I was going to go to university to get a trade,
yes,
to become an accountant or something. And then I had to break the terrible news to them that what I was really passionate about was the written word, was literature. And they thought, what kind of job are you going to get with that? Well, good question, because when I left university, I just couldn't get a job. I couldn't think of anything I wanted to do. This was after doing a PhD. So I'd been at Edinburgh University for 7 years. Got married to Miranda the summer of 86, and she was working as a civil servant in London.
Yeah.
So I moved down to London to be with her, and the only bit of London we could afford was a two-bedroom flat in Tottenham. And it was very handy because she worked at Victoria.
You're on the Victoria line.
Tottenham Hale is on the Victoria line. And then I got a job. Well, she started off supporting me, and I would sit at home trying to be a full-time writer, but that wasn't going well at all.
Yeah.
And then I got a job in a polytechnic as a secretary. And then I looked in the Guardian one day and it was a job for a hi-fi journalist. And I loved hi-fi equipment, although I couldn't afford much of it, but I liked it. So I applied and I got the job, and that was in Crystal Palace. So it was a 1 hour, 30 minute each way commute. And if I did it by car, it was 90 minutes each way. If I did it on the train and the bus, it was 90 minutes each way. So I couldn't win. But it was a good job in a way, because it got me used to, again, using the writing muscle, but also writing every day. And you had to fill sheets of paper. You knew that the review had to fill a page, therefore it had to be 600 words. And you knew that it had to be done by Friday, because the magazine was going to print at the weekend.
Yes.
So the stuff I did as a journalist, I think, was very, very, would become very useful to me when I became a full-time writer.
Yes. But, I mean, because we're on the old mental health department here, that was the beginning, if I'm not wrong, of where the super anxiety panic attacks started to appear.
Yeah, I think the all that commuting, plus the fact that we didn't have much money and we were living in Tottenham and finding it all very stressful. Miranda had a very high, very stressful, high powered position in the civil service. Yeah, I think it just got to us. And I jumped on the tube one day and thought I was having a heart attack.
Yeah.
And jumped back off the tube and went to see the GP in Tottenham, who said he thought it was a panic attack and what I needed to do was to take some time off.
Did he actually know that's what it... I mean, did he say those words? Because that was...
I can't remember if he said panic attack, but I think he must have done.
Right.
Because then Miranda got me a self-help book on how to deal with panic attacks, which was when I realized that I wasn't the only person in the world who suffered from this condition. It was just like a surge of adrenaline, a huge surge of adrenaline, and an inability to catch a breath.
Yes.
What I did to start with was I just got on another train and ended up in Scarborough, staying in a B&B for a few days out of season and walking up and down the blustery beach with headphones on, listening to Van Morrison.
Right.
But Miranda said, look, we've just got to get out of London. We've got to give up this high pressure environment. And so we started planning the move to rural France.
Yeah.
Which in some ways was a mixed blessing, because when we arrived in rural France, we had no skills. I couldn't even speak the language.
Right.
And suddenly we were completely dependent on my writing for our income. So the panic attacks were still coming. And I would drive through the night, the rural roads between the fields around our old farmhouse that we lived in. And I would just scream into the void as a way of earthing all that kind of frustration and emotion and adrenaline.
I think that's a great way of putting it, earthing, because that's, I think, what it feels like, unearth, isn't it? That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
You're going to die. And I mean, maybe you can just, expand on that, because I think the thing with mental health stuff is that people are always very glib and go, oh, yeah, I'm having a panic attack. And they don't actually know what that means.
It's a horrible, horrible feeling to have, not catching a breath. Miranda, or hyperventilating, which is part of it. And Miranda, because she'd also read the self-help book, got the paper bag thing. You had to get a bag and breathe into the bag, and that would control your breathing. And just kind of switch off or channel it. I the thing where I could almost, when I got this surge of adrenaline, I could almost feed it down to my toes and feel it. As I said, earthing, I could feel it. I could get it out of my system by sort of pushing downwards, and letting it all sort of leak out.
But it's frightening, isn't it?
But yeah, I mean, waking up in the middle of the night, because it could happen when you're sound asleep and you suddenly get this feeling that you're about to die. And I would leap out of bed and just stand there shaking with my heart thumping. But once I knew that I wasn't having a heart attack and I wasn't dying, then I could control it. It was never as scary as it was the first few times.
Interesting. I mean, but is it not something that is like a sort of massive exaggerated form of fear, you know, that you are very frightened of something and it's exaggerated, or is that just not, or is that another part?
I mean, that adrenaline comes with that kind of fear. It's like you've had a shock, you've had a fright, the bogeyman has jumped out at you, and all your senses going to the red, as it were.
Well
The
put.
the meter goes jumps from one place to another place, and yeah, I mean, I think the biggest help for me was knowing that I just wasn't dying, that this wasn't terminal. And there were things that I could do to ameliorate it. And I mean, the past few years, it's very seldom that I get a panic. I mean, I do still get them, but it's very seldom that I get them, and I'm much better able to control them.
Are you, if you don't mind me asking, I mean, are you an anxious person? I mean, you know, some people say, oh, he's such a worrier, Ted, you know, and but I mean, you know, anxiety is, I mean, for instance, I go to a lot of schools and companies and stuff talking about mental health. And in the last 5 years, anxiety and panic attacks are really high on the list, very high. And I'm, you know, it's quite an interesting thing. But what you say is really good, that, you know, for you, once you knew, once you got some measure of it, then you contain it. And it's like with all mental health with kids, if you say to them, look, this actually will not last forever, you know, this is normally what will happen, then it makes it so much more bearable.
Yeah, it was kind of compounded in our case because, after a few years in France, our youngest son was born with severe disabilities. And how was I going to handle that? And I became very obsessive because we needed certain equipment that had to, when we were going out with him, he had to have all his medication with him and this, that, and the other. And also he had no sense of danger. So to make sure any room he was in was going to be safe, that he couldn't injure himself or smash things up or anything. And I became hyper vigilant, and that kind of led to a minor form of OCD, I suppose. Where even now, where our son doesn't live with us anymore, if there's a glass or a cup that I feel is too near the edge of the draining board, I will push it in towards the wall so it doesn't, nobody nudges it and it falls off. That just became a coping mechanism. It became one of many coping mechanisms.
No, that's, I mean, I know that sometimes people with panic attacks who continually get them, they get given beta blockers, to lower their heart rate, and lots of breathing exercises. I don't know if that happened to you.
No, I've never done that. I mean, as you say, I'm a naturally fairly anxious person. I mean, as a writer, you always are. You're always afraid that that was your last good book, or the book you're about to start writing is going to be terrible. Nobody's going to want to read that. Who's going to want to read this? Your audience is disappearing before your eyes. Or you've got that imposter syndrome that a lot of creative people get, where you feel, well, this is where I'm going to get found out. This is the book where everybody suddenly goes, wait a minute, this guy is naked. The emperor has no clothes.
I hope you don't feel like that, Ian. That would be a
I think we all do. I think we all feel like that. I think pretty much every creative person I've spoken to feels a bit like that. And many feel they're in the wrong job. The number of times I've met musicians who want to be actors and actors who want to be poets and poets who want to be painters and painters who want to be novelists. It's extraordinary.
Well, I think the continual feeling of being found out is really terrible. But hopefully you have got about three wardrobes of awards and things that must say something, you know.
Yeah, that is a validation. It's always good to get a little bit of validation at some point. And validation has come for me sometimes at very important points in my life. Having become the full-time breadwinner for the household, the books for a long time still weren't selling very well.
Yes.
And I was beginning to have real doubts. And then when our youngest son was born disabled, we thought, well, we're probably going to have to move back to the UK, because dealing with the French medical world, although Miranda, my wife, speaks very good French, when you're in a heightened emotional state, you're not always quite understanding what the specialist is trying to tell you between the lines.
Yeah.
In a foreign language. And also the nearest facilities for our son were 50 kilometers away, which was a daily trek if we wanted to get anything done. So we made moves to move back to the UK, and the books were selling, but not in huge numbers. And then soon after we moved back, I won the Gold Dagger for the best crime novel of the year. And that gave my publisher a little bit of stimulus to put some money into promoting the books. And the books did start to sell in bigger numbers.
Yeah.
So, you know, after, I think it was after Rebus novel number 9 or 10, I began to hit the bestseller lists. Well, that was after more than a decade in the game and having written more than a dozen books.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. But I mean, well, you know, that's great. And you came back, and so Miranda was a hell of a support on to you. I don't just mean in the obvious way, but with that panic attacks and anxiety stuff, that she sort of got you rocking and reeling.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, when we got the diagnosis that our son had Angelman syndrome, is the condition he's got, you sort of cling to each other like you're clinging on a raft. We had been living in France for the best part of 6 years in an old farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, the two of us hardly out of each other's sight for more than a few hours at a stretch.
Yeah.
And so it was quite a close bond. But, you know, I mean, I know lots of families, lots of people who've had children with severe disabilities, and often it leads to the end of the marriage. That bond is broken between the partners, and one will leave. One is unable to cope, and they leave. And we were really fortunate. We had plenty of friends around us and we had each other. And, you know, although I'm sure Miranda had times when she thought she was at her end of her tether.
Yeah.
And I certainly had plenty of times when I thought I was nearing the end of my tether. Usually somebody could pick up the baton and you could have a little break.
And you really, without being cliched, you really became, you know, stronger, you know, between.
Possibly.
You.
I mean, possibly we did. We were lucky in a way, because by the time Kit was becoming big and difficult to handle, I was earning good money from the books and we could afford care.
Yeah.
So we sort of bought in a full-time carer who would look after him, which eased the load hugely. And then we found Kit a fantastic care home that he could move into full-time, only 20 minutes walk from where we live in Edinburgh. So that all worked out. So there'd been a few lucky bits of serendipity along the way.
No, well, that's all fantastic, I think. And, you know, normally I say this at the end of our Shed Talks, but I always say it's quite a famous Scottish doctor in 1873, I think it was, who was asked, what do you need to be happy? And he said, you need three things to be happy. Something to do, someone to love, and something to hope for. And I always think that's on the money for me. And, you know, because I think it is very difficult sometimes when you've got conditions, as you, I think, alluded to elsewhere, mental health is mental health. It's not something to be ashamed of. You know, it's just, it happens and you got to deal with it. And I think with panic attacks and anxiety, one of the things that can happen, which we've sort of alluded to, is there's a thing that's known as catastrophization, you know, where literally you take everything, you go, all my books are going to be found to have terrible things in them, and I'm going to be sued for £9 billion. Miranda is going to run off with Jeremy Thomas, who's a very attractive young man, and the boys are going to go against me, and I'm going to get 1 million parking tickets. That's just that's just this morning.
Well, the problem with being a writer and someone who's always had this very vivid imagination is that I can easily imagine all of that happening.
Yeah,
I can imagine all of that into being, and write it down as if it actually did happen. I just hope to hell it never does. There's no question in my mind that if you find a vocation, if you find something that is your passion in life, and you can make a go of it, then that is going to help you a hell of a lot.
Yes.
You know, if you're in a dead-end job, or you've got no job and you've got issues with mental health or anything else, or looking after a disabled relative, whatever, you're going to find that a hell of a lot harder than I found it.
Yeah.
Because I've got something I love that I can always turn to, which will take my mind off it. I mean, during the pandemic, I took my mind off the pandemic by writing more than I've ever written before, none of it involving the pandemic.
Yeah.
So it was like a blessed, it was like an escape tunnel. Like I was tunneling out of Camp COVID.
I think that's great. I really love it. I mean, just talk about writing for a second and the power of writing, though, that, you know, we talk about people having very poor self-esteem, shame of the way they were brought up, things that happened to them as children, etc., and it can disable them, you know, in their later life and impede them. And often, well, in my experience of this, when people write about things, they expel it out of them, expiation, if you like. I mean, do you agree with that?
It works for me, but I don't know if it works for everybody. I mean, I'm sure we can all think of creative geniuses who were very troubled. And the creative genius didn't help them in that, with that at all. Plenty of people who committed suicide too young who were very troubled but were brilliant at what they did. Sometimes the pressure just gets too much and you can't cope with it, or you dig it to that catastrophization that you were talking about, where you think it's all got to go to ashes. It can't keep being this good. It's all going to turn to absolute ashes. So I should exit the stage while I'm at the top of my game, not when I'm at the bottom of my game. So it can be difficult. And I think a lot of people who have been geniuses have had, you know, all kinds of psychological issues, you know, whether they might be slightly autistic,
yeah.
Because that gives you the impetus to keep concentrating, to keep focusing on one small thing. You think about the kind of art that some artists produce over and over again. They're just working on this small piece, this piece, this piece, this piece. And you can almost see it in the work sometimes. You know, famously with some artists, you just look at the work and you think, well, you were a tortured soul, but you were able to transfer that onto a canvas. But did that give you any succor or help lighten the load? Sometimes yes, but a lot of times no.
Yeah. Well, it's well put. And we had the previous guest on Shed Talks actually talked a lot about that. It's a very interesting thing. So, you know, I know we haven't got much time, but I just, you know, thought we'd talk about a couple of other things that are very interesting. Ian Banks, I know, was a very good friend of yours, and someone you admired. The great, you know, great writer, great guy from all accounts. I don't know if you ever stopped to think about the Wasp Factory, you know, as, you know, that being, you know, it's boring, but, you know, you look at the character, the young guy in the Wasp Factory, not the elder brother. And it, I mean, it's quite interesting, that condition that he was in terms of mental health, if you like. I don't know whether it struck you or not.
No, it's not. Well, I mean, I suppose it did. It's such a dark book for a first novel, and he was very young when he wrote it. I mean, he was writing a lot. He wrote at university, he wrote a lot of science fiction, and then only started to get published later on as a science fiction writer. But The Wasp Factory repelled as many people as it attracted. which possibly was part of why it became famous. I remember when the paperback came out, they printed all the bad reviews as well as all the good ones on the cover.
Did they?
And you know, they would sort of take a turn about. But in his in you know in life, he was an extraordinary, larger than life, gregarious figure, and had a childlike wonderment about the world, and always questioning, and always laughing, and always joking. And he just seemed to love life.
Yeah.
But when he got the diagnosis and he knew that he didn't have long to live, there was an extraordinary kind of final act, really, where he proposed to his girlfriend so that, you know, she would become his. She said, "Will you do me the honor of becoming my widow?" And they went off on adventures together, and he made sure everything was that his affairs were as up to date as they could
In
be.
order, in order,
Yeah,
yes.
absolutely. And having forsaken his loved sports cars to become green, he then went and bought himself a BMW M5 and would barrel around the roads of Scotland. I mean, he was another person who he had an interesting thing that he did, which we've been talking about OCD and autistic spectrum disorder. He had a plan to drive every single road in Scotland, and he had this very complete map book. And every time he drove a road he'd not been on before, he coloured it in. And he kept this map, and was desperately trying to have driven every single piece of road in Scotland. Never quite got there.
Brilliant, brilliant. Did you like the business?
Yeah.
I just know that I say that because I know you know the music, you are a big music fan and you know a bit about the music business.
Yeah, and Espadere Street was another novel that he wrote about the music business. Yeah, and he did write music, and whether he kept in it, I'm sure the recordings exist, and I'm sure he had plans to put it out, and some of it might even have appeared on the internet. But he did write music. He never appeared on stage playing music, not to my knowledge. But like me, he was a frustrated rock star, I guess. You know, so many writers I know, especially crime writers, would much rather be rock stars, and many of us have tried. We've been in bands when we were younger, or as people of a certain age, we have rejoined bands or joined bands and are trying to give it a go, thinking it's never too late. Yes, it is. Yes, it is too
No,
late.
never.
But that doesn't stop us from trying.
I think you could have been, well, he's a bit older than you, but you know, we could get Nick Kent or Charles Charles Murray to be an alter ego in Rankin. I mean, I think you could have done that really well. I'm quite sure of that actually. Anyway, yes, I probably got mixed up on that Banks book, but I believed every world he told me about. Right, so now you are, I don't know whether you have finished William McIlvany, you know, the Dark Remains. This is extraordinary, sort of, I don't know, honoring, I hate to say this, but it's honoring the dead, isn't it?
I mean, William McIlvany, great Scottish novelist. He died a few years ago, and his widow found some handwritten notes that she thought looked as though they were notes towards a new book, and she typed them up and approached me with a view to finishing it, to see if it was possible to finish it, so there would be a new William McIlvany book. And it was a crime novel. He wrote three novels with a detective, and it was one of those, but it was like a prequel. It was set in the early 70s. And I gave it a go. Yep, and she is very happy with it, which delights me. She said it was as though he was in the room with her as she read it,
Oh,
which
brilliant.
was just glorious. And it's going to be released the beginning of September.
Oh,
Uh,
great,
so
great.
I'm waiting to hear what people think. It's an act of homage, and it's an act of ventriloquism. I hope nobody sees me in that book. I hope they hear the voice of William McIlvany.
Yeah, and he's quite an interesting, well, there's a whole history of him and Laidlaw and other things. We're going to look out for that. All right, and we have reached that exciting moment now in life where we talk about Ian Rankin's Life Jackets. And we're going to go straight in. Ready? We're going to talk about film. And what we're going to talk about is what every good Scottish red-blooded male talks about, Gregory's Girl.
Gregory's Girl, it's such a great movie.
Well, it was.
I must have seen it 20 or 30 times. I saw it in the cinema several times. It used to run every day in a small cinema in Edinburgh. For years, it ran every single day, and we would go along and watch it.
Wasn't the actress Claire Grogan. How many times did you fall in love with her?
Well, you weren't supposed to fall in love with her. You're supposed to fall in love with the footballer. Okay. Yeah. No, she was terrific in it, and John Gordon Sinclair. Yeah. The whole cast were fantastic. And they didn't feel like actors. It felt like you were actually watching real teenagers going through real things. And it captured small-town life, whether Scotland or elsewhere. It just captured small-town life beautifully. And, if it was on TV this week, I would watch it.
And it was hope, wasn't it? I mean, that's right. I remember of it. Hope, you know, that things can happen. And, stop being a cynic. You know, get on.
And about, you know, how gawky and quirky and stupid young boys are, or teenage boys are, compared to girls.
Yes.
The girls are very, very controlled and know what's going on. The boys are just stupid and have to be led by the nose. But it's great.
Okay, that's excellent. All right, I'm just going to talk one other of yours, Where Eagles Dare. Now.
Another great Scottish movie, Jeremy.
Yes.
I'll tell you why, because it's based on a novel by Alistair MacLean, who was a native Gaelic speaker from the Western Isles.
Okay, you got that in very well, actually, because I was going to say that was Richard McBurt.
It's great. It's a boy's own adventure. You know, it's very escapist. The goodies are good, the baddies are bad. There's Nazis, there's Clint Eastwood, there's Richard Burton.
McPherson.
What's not to like?
He was great in there, and Clint McEastwood. Do you remember, there was the nasty Nazi... was a British actor called Darren Nesbitt. You know, he had that extraordinary blonde hair. And he was a very...
Very steely eyes and big rubbery lips.
He was
lips.
A very good Nazi. I mean, he was fantastic, actually.
The number of times he played a bad guy in British TV in the 70s.
I know, that is a boys' film. So people who are listening to this, boys who are listening to this, need to mark that one down. I've watched that every time it comes down on telly. I watch it. So, books. Now, The Prime Minister, G. Brody, I have got that here. I'm halfway through. I know I should have finished it before, but I am really, really enjoying it. Like a lot of people, I think, you know, people, the film was so popular that they go, oh, was there a book? You know, I mean, literally, even though they might know Muriel Spark.
And it's a very short book. It's 125 pages, but it's a TARDIS. It's much bigger on the inside than the outside. It's just full of stuff. It's funny. It's tragic. It's clever. It's witty. It's complex. You've got this teacher, Miss Jean Brodie. Is she the hero of the book or the villain? Is she both? You've got the girls growing up. It's very good. It's very good on girls coming toward, you know, reaching towards womanhood.
Yes.
And the games they play, some of them more vicious than others. And the lies they tell and the adventures they have. And it's very good on Edinburgh. I mean, it kind of just that period, interwar Edinburgh, when you had all these Miss Jean Brodie figures, these spinsters and widows, because a lot of the men had not come back from World War One. So it was there was an imbalance in society at that time. And it captures that period really well. It's a very, very enjoyable and clever book that you should be able to read in an afternoon, Jeremy.
I know. I will chastise myself in the Catholic way as soon as possible. I could tell you, you probably already know, that Muriel Spark herself is quite an interesting life. You know,
very interesting.
Went
life,
out to Rhodesia, as it was then, married a guy 15 years older than her. It turned out to be, oh my God, manic depressive, bipolar. Terrible situation, had a couple of kids, came back, then went to live in New York. And then went to live in Rome, and then went to live in Tuscany.
And before all that, I mean, she was living in London sort of during and just after World War II, and she's bringing up a kid on her own, and she was taking Dexedrine, I think it was, to try and stay awake all night so she could write and stuff, and she became very mentally ill. She started to hear voices and think that she was a character in a book. And she was helped financially, I think, by Graham Greene, amongst others. And she became a Catholic, although she'd grown up kind of half Protestant and half Jewish.
Yes, that's right.
And then eventually, went and lived in Italy for the last part of her life. And her life story is extraordinary. And she used a lot of it in her books. When you read her, my PhD was on the novels of Muriel Spark, and when you read her books, all of that is in there.
But all the business of her son, who she really did not like by the end of her life, and who didn't like her, and he, fascinating story. Okay, well, we're gone now. TV, your choices are The West Wing and Blackadder, and in a very Ian Rankin way, you've put bracket series two, close bracket.
Series two of Blackadder, not series two of West Wing. I will happily watch the whole of the West Wing, although I think there is a slight fall off in quality. But it's if you're a liberal, it's the dream of what you think the American presidency could be. A White House staffed by very smart people who are always on the side of right against might and on the side of justice, and a very charismatic and capable president who's doing mostly the right things. Yeah. And where we've just been in American history, it just does seem like a fantasy now. Blackadder, because it just, the funniest thing on television, I think, ever. Season two, Miranda Richardson as Queen Elizabeth, Stephen Fry is in there. Season one, I thought was in, I wasn't a huge fan of. I didn't think it had found its feet, but my God, it does in season two. Richard Curtis comes in to do some of the writing and stuff. Ben Elton is in there, of course. Yeah. And they're at the top of their game. And just every line is beautifully pitched. Every line is funny. The character is great. I could happily watch that series over and over.
I love Miranda Richardson in that. I just think that whole thing where they all have to bow and scrape.
Yeah.
And she's like this. I mean, again, that's very funny. Right, music. Now, you've got two choices here. Music for Airports by Brian Eno. And then you've gone Solid Air by John Martin. Well, we know which is the totally superior record album in that, but I won't comment on that. Brian Eno might be better known, I don't know, as a member of Roxy Music's, a keyboard player, who then went on to become quite a famous record producer, produced Coldplay, that's the latest stuff. You like that whole ambient thing from time to time, Ian?
Well, we're talking about, a lifeboat. I want something that's going to calm me down. And I find that the ambient music of Brian Eno calms me down. I often fall asleep to it. I love it on my phone, and I have the phone under my pillow, and I will fall asleep to an ambient album. And music for Airports is fantastic. I can work to it. I can sit and work. And the music, which is hardly music at all, just creates a bubble. The outside world disappears, and I'm in my little bubble, and I'm writing away. So I use ambient music a lot, and that was one of the first ambient albums I bought and listened to, so that's why I chose that. John Martin is my Desert Island album. I just think he's an extraordinary figure. I mean, he was an angel and a demon contained within the same person. Voice of an angel, looked like an angel in his early years, but a furious temper, a terrible husband, etc., etc. All that stuff. I like complex characters, and there's not many characters in the music world that have been as complex as John Martin.
Solid Air is a particular album, though, that has lasted a long time, and it just happens to have that feel, that vocal delivery. And I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's 1975 and you're, had a few jazz Woodbine cigarettes, even now you can put it on.
And the title track apparently is about his friend Nick Drake, who committed suicide very young after making, I think, three albums.
Yeah,
incredibly shy and introverted.
For the same record company.
Yeah,
Island Records. Yeah,
so there's a poignancy. And it's a beautiful song. It's a beautiful song. And Danny Thompson's double bass is gorgeous. Everything about it is just amazing. It's the one track that I chose when I was on Desert Island Discs on Radio 4. I said, this is the one song I can't live without. And the day I was down there to record that, I was in a restaurant eating lunch with my agent, and John Martin was sitting at a table outside drinking wine with his friends in a very raucous manner. And that was my chance to go up to him and tell him why I was there and how much he meant to me. And of course I didn't.
I don't blame you.
Because I didn't. I wasn't sure which John Martin I would meet.
He would have decked you. Now, exercise. Are you saying to me, Ian Rankin, that exercise has no place in your day, your life?
Well, no, I mean you're it said exercise slash hobbies, and I mean hobbies, cryptic crosswords, Sudoku and jigsaws during lockdown. Exercise never in the past, but fairly recently, within living memory, I took up running. My wife was doing the Couch to 5K, which is an NHS app that you can download onto your phone. And she said, you should come out with me. And I started going with her. And if you keep it up, you will eventually be able to run 5K. I didn't think I would. And a friend of mine who is a runner persuaded me to go out with him on a Sunday. So there's a few of us now go out. I go out 3 or 4 times a week. Now, mostly it's only for 3, 4, 5K. But sometimes on a Sunday, we do 8, 9, or 10. And I'm 61 years old, Jeremy. And when I was 40, I couldn't have run 10K.
Yes.
So it does say something that, although, during the winter, I went out running in this ice and I shouldn't have done because I fell over. And 6 months on, I'm still recovering.
Yeah. No, I was just worried about that. And I love the idea of jigsaws because I think very therapeutic for people. A lot of people will now think, oh, Ian Rankin does jigsaws. Oh, it's okay then. Okay, I'll do it. And, you know.
It's mindfulness. It's mindfulness. And it's also something we tend to do as a family. Yeah. So if our older son is on holiday with us or comes round, we might have a jigsaw on the go and all three of us might sit down and do a little bit of jigsaw.
No, I think it's great. Manual tasks. It's manual, it's social, it's very, very groovy. I mean, I think that's great. So, okay, last couple of questions, and naturally they're trick questions. You said once that if you had a regret, it was that you hadn't told your parents that you loved them. Do you think is that still true with you?
Yeah, I mean, sitting with my mother at her bedside as she was dying, I mean, I had plenty of opportunities to say something, but there was an embarrassment factor of saying you love your mum or something when you're 19. And so I never did quite say it. And of course I wish they'd both, because my dad died when I was 29. I was just as we were readying, my wife and I were readying to leave the UK and move to France. He died in his sleep. So he never got to see me be a success. My mother never got to see me be a published writer, and my dad never got to see me be a successful writer. So I wish they'd both stuck around a bit longer so I could wave my finger and say, you see, I knew what I was doing when I studied literature at university. You thought I was never going to get a decent paying career. It's all worked out
okay. It's all worked out. Oh, that's very nice. I like that. Well, we'll send that message up to them. Okay, this is the last question here. Don't worry. I'm somebody who really likes the relationship between Rebus and Siobhan in your books. I like them both. Separately and together. And I wonder, it seems to me that, I thought that they were going to get married at one point early along.
Oh.
I know that's a terrible thing to say. Well, they could have had an affair. And
no.
I know they could have done ages ago. But now it's a very different relationship. And my question is that Rebus seems to be becoming like a father figure to her, really. And do you think that Siobhan could ever, move into the center stage of the books?
I don't know. I mean, I keep waiting for a story to come my way which feels like it's her story, that she's the person best placed to be in the center of it. And it hasn't happened yet, but that doesn't mean to say it won't happen in the future. I think you're right about I never was going to take them into bed together. It would have destroyed their working relationship and their friendship, I think. But during the pandemic, of course, Rebus had to isolate because he's got health issues. Not only is a man of a certain age, but he's got emphysema, as it used to be called. And so COPD, we now call it. So she became his carer. She insisted that he not leave his flat. He lives in two floors up in a tenement building. And she insisted he not leave. And she would bring his shopping and bring him a newspaper and bring him a few cans of beer or a bottle of scotch and stuff. And she would take the dog out for a walk, so he didn't even have to take his dog out for a walk. And it was, I was asked by the National Theatre of Scotland to do a little monologue for Rebus about lockdown. And having written it, which was again very cathartic for me to find out how he was coping, how would he cope? The only way I could find out was to actually write about it. They then gave it to Brian Cox, the great Scottish actor, not the astrophysicist, and he recorded it on screen. So you can go into YouTube and look up Rebus Lockdown Blues, and you will find a Rebus of a certain age and how he feels about Siobhan. Now the kind of, the balance of power has shifted in their relationship. He's no longer a cop. He's retired. She's still a cop. So he's very envious of the fact that she still gets to actively go out on cases and he doesn't. He has to inveigle his way into a police investigation. It's really interesting the way the balance has shifted in our relationship. And I think that will continue if and when I write the next book.
Yes. Well, I don't think there's any if. I hope. okay, well, I'm not going to ask you any more questions, Ian. I'm just going to say you've been a great sport and you're a top geezer. And thank you so much for appearing on Shed Talks.
Thank great. You, Jeremy.
All right, then. See Cheers. You then, Ian. Cheers. Bye. 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 And it's welcome to the very best part of the show, Karen Cowan.
Hi, hello, Jeremy, and hello, everyone.
Great, great to see you. Actually, to see you, we're actually in person on this episode for the first time in the history of Shed Talks, and that is great. And what is more great is we've just had a really, really sort of very interesting conversation with Ian Rankin. What did you think?
I thought it was absolutely fascinating and it was a real treat to listen to it. And I think, once again, Ian is a tremendous survivor. He's had several really difficult things in his life. The death of his mother at a very young age and coping with a very severely disabled child. But he seems to have, just listening to him, reached a space where he's kind of accepted and come to terms with things and doing really well.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could say, well, you know, he's written over 23, 24, 25 books. And, you know, it's all come right. But I thought what was great about him was that I thought he was very sort of honest and humble, really, in talking about all of the panic attacks and anxiety stuff that he's had. I mean, I thought that was really, really, really good. What do you think on that?
Well, I think he's come a long way and he's written some marvellous books, and which I've really enjoyed myself. And he said that writing itself has helped him. And yes, he spoke about the panic attacks and that he does still sometimes have them. But it seems that the worst time for the panic attacks was when he was in a very insecure and difficult situation in London. And he must have been absolutely exhausted with the 3 hour a day commute. And
But that went on, the panic attacks, I think, went on for the next, you know, at least the next 10 years, if not more.
Yes. And he was having a very hard time then, you know, trying to make money out of writing, having children, one of whom was severely disabled. And he's likely to have been extremely stressed out and exhausted. And no wonder something had to go and he started having panic attacks, and thank goodness those have calmed down now as his life has got better through his own enormous efforts and through his writing and through his what clearly is seems like a really solid relationship with his wife and his ability to get really good care for his son. And it sounds like as time goes on, these things have receded, but it sounds like a really, really bad time for him. And panic attacks are absolutely terrifying when they happen. And I take my hat off to him.
Do you have, I mean, as I alluded to in the conversation, it seems to me that anxiety and panic attacks are much higher up the pecking order nowadays, particularly the young people. Do you treat people with this?
Yes, I do treat people with anxiety and panic attacks. And sometimes the panic attacks are part of a much bigger picture, such as post-traumatic stress disorder or a reaction to complex trauma. And sometimes they slightly more stand alone, and there are very specific, often CBT-based treatments that help a lot with overcoming panic disorder and panic attacks, particularly around checking your breathing, because it's fight or flight, and not getting rid of enough carbon dioxide is actually part of what causes panic attacks. So learning to breathe regularly is very important.
Does blood sugar have a...
Oh, blood sugar has an enormous effect. And I often hear people say, you know, it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It just came out of nowhere. And I said, when had you last eaten? And often they hadn't eaten, say, since breakfast time. So yes, very low blood sugar causes similar symptoms to anxiety, which you then interpret as, gosh, there's something to be frightened of.
Yeah.
And then you then go into panic mode. And of course, you know, we're meant to be anxious. And some of the symptoms of anxiety and panic disorder would be useful to us if we were, for example, cavemen or women trying to escape from a saber-toothed tiger.
Yes, yes.
But we're not. So, for example, you can feel sick because you need your body to be empty in order to be able to run away. You can have diarrhea because you need your body to be empty in order to be able to run away.
Oh, right.
You need to sweat to get lighter to be able to run away. So it's a kind of part of the fight or flight response kind of gone wrong, really.
But would you say that, you know, on the one hand, you've got panic attacks, which is absolutely terrifying, extreme, as Ian was saying, oh my God, I'm going to have a heart attack, terrible. But I'm interested to know whether that is bolted on to the idea of catastrophization or whether that's a separate issue.
Well, I don't think anything in mental health is necessarily a separate issue, but yes, catastrophization. I mean, for example, in Ian's case, there was a huge buildup of stress of not really having enough money by the sounds of things, trying to make a go of it as a writer, the time in London, then the new house in France, having a severely disabled child, trying to keep the marriage together, the background of the death of his mother when he was young, so the background of a loss of a big support. So lots and lots of difficult things, and perhaps catastrophizing, thinking, I'm not going to be able to cope with this, I'm not going to make enough money, you know, I'm not going to make enough money to keep my wife and children. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'd tell you one thing that I thought was really interesting. I didn't pick up on it in the conversation, but Ian said that, you know, basically he leant heavily on his wife during this period. What they did was that they got a book. They got a self-help book on anxiety and panic attacks, and they got the brown paper bag blowing in the back. But they kept referring to that. He kept referring to that book. And what I thought was great was that, you know, we live in an age where, you know, people go, well, I've bought all the books, I've got the TV series, I'm seeing 19,000 therapists, whatever. But actually, if you've got a good book and you believe in it, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I think, and there's some absolutely amazing self-help books there. For example, the Robinson series, Overcoming series, is brilliant.
Yes.
And in the case of panic disorder, there are so many practical things that you can do that help. And if you, for example, not drinking Coca-Cola and caffeinated drinks, remembering to breathe normally, eating regularly, drinking enough water,
yes,
challenging difficult thoughts. There are lots of very practical, sort of relatively simple things to think about that can help ameliorate the number and difficulty of panic attacks you have.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, what was good that you said, you know, which I'm just thinking about now, was the idea of that nothing in mental health is unconnected. And I was just thinking as you were speaking then, you know, about the whole idea of, you know, who people who have really, really bad OCD, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder, and how they, and this is weird, but how they have rituals to do things. And I wonder whether there's almost a spillover sometimes where, you know, that if you have panic attack and you know, well, I know how I get out of this, I blow into a paper bag, I stand on my head, you know, put my, you know, the six things that you do and you can calm it all down.
Yeah, particularly as I say, in the case of panic disorder, I think that's particularly apposite because there are some very clear things that you can do to help with panic disorder and with calming down panic and in the sort of longer term with challenging the difficult thoughts around what causes the panic attack. And in the much longer term, perhaps thinking about how past events link into a general feeling of underlying stress. And in Ian's case, the death of his mother when he was very young, and also the fact that he felt so different and how tough it was to be different and how he negotiated that. You know, there may have been some spillover from that, all building up to make your coping space a little bit smaller. And as you come to terms with that and accept that and understand, that also helps with ameliorating things like panic disorder and anxiety and so on.
Yes.
And also in Ian's case, the writing, you know, he found writing so enormously helpful to him, right from his diaries to writing about Rebus and the diaries that his sister gave him.
Yeah, yeah. You see, I think that's an interesting thing, and we're not here really to analyze Ian, but I mean, if you look at that childhood and you think, you know, one of the things he said was that the reason he didn't express certain things was that he'd been brought up in a very buttoned up way, where you didn't express things. So I must think to myself, well, ergo, when he goes to university and he's a fish out of water, or, you know, this is all really horribly different, they're all horrible people here, and then goes into the stress zone of trying to write books in France, that he doesn't actually have the emotional equipment to express it, and therefore it goes out in that way of panic attacks. I don't know if that's fair.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think it was really good when Ian said about, you know, how he used to sort of walk along sort of screaming into the void and sort of earthing himself. And that was about kind of beginning to allow himself to experience emotions. And of course, a big part of kind of lots of psychotherapy nowadays is about being able to recognize and feel emotions without being scared of them. And again, that kind of does tend to, in the longer term, ameliorate panic disorder.
Yes, that's a great line though, isn't it? That being, you know, wanting to be earthed, you know, like an electric charge is great. I really like that.
And I thought it was great that Ian said he went to Scarborough and... And walked along the beaches and things. I love Scarborough playing Van Morrison. And he kind of needed that rest and space, and how much music has sort of helped him. And
yes,
you know, that helps lots of other people as well.
No, that's the music side, I think, is great that he's still really interested in music. And I also love the fact that, you know, he could be asked to come on this, you know, podcast. It is the greatest one, obviously, in the world. Mm-hmm. But and to be that, you know, nice and humble and go, look, you know, I had all these things, you know. I mean, he's an immensely successful person, and he doesn't need to do that.
I know, it was wonderful of him, and I'm hoping that this will help other people listening to people like Ian, who so kindly came on, and hearing about how they got through and how things are okay.
Yeah. What was your favourite or a couple of favourite things that came out of the life jackets? You know, which ones did you really like?
Well, I loved everything about it. I love the way he is, and it wasn't in the life jackets, but the way he talks about hanging out in pubs with his friends and so on. I loved him talking about Blackadder and the comedy and it being fun, and the music for Airports and how that really helps him.
Brian Eno.
Yeah, helps him blank out his mind. And I loved him talking about The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie and how important Muriel Spark, she, you know, he wrote his dissertation on her. And And Gregory's Girl, of course, and
yes, and of course you could never say that Ian was Scottish at all.
No.
Well, you know, I think that he is engaged in life, and that's a great thing. He's committed to doing lots of things. But and I think it was a great if you were young, and you know happened to be going through all that anxiety, panic attacks, depression, or whatever. That is very inspiring. As was our previous guest, Gordon Darroch, also from Edinburgh University. But I think that, you know, it's very inspiring if you're a writer and you're struggling, you know, to look at the things that Ian did and still does. And, you know, and we would just add to that, you know, the idea of having a routine to keep yourself, you know, anchored to the ground.
I think very much so. And I think, as you say, I think that's perhaps the biggest thing that came across about Ian, that what you just said is that he seems so engaged with life, you know, with his friends, with his interests, with his music, with his family.
In the present.
Yeah.
In the present, isn't it? And so it's quite, yeah. Anyway, I think we've been far too nice to him. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
He's a good crack. Yeah. You know, he's a good crack. We like him very much. And well, that's it. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute privilege to listen to Ian, and a privilege to be on this programme.
Tip top and totally tidy. We'll see you next time. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you to Stuart Bagshaw, our top engineer editor. Thank you to B. Brooke, our top administrator, production manager. Thank you to Karen Cowan, our top psychologist. If you want to find out more about Shed Talks, visit our website, jeremythomastalks.co.uk. Please sign up to the newsletter. If you want to write to us or find out anything about anybody or contact anyone on the show, inquiries@jeremythomastalks.co.uk. You can find us on Facebook at Shed Talks, Shed Talks, Twitter at JT Shed Talks, Instagram-Jeremy Thomas Talks. So it's all been tip top and totally tidy. Stay safe, be groovy. Please sign up, support, and share this. Thanks a lot. Goodbye. I can be a vendor, in stolen and cold, we've been living on solid air. We've been finding and cold, you've been living on solid air. I don't know what's going on inside. I can tell you that it's hard to hide when you're living on taking your time, but you
I can tell you.